they will happen again. The mass shootings will continue to happen. And on a daily basis, depending on where you live, right? Depending on where you practice, you will see, you know, suicides. If you live in the inner city, you're going to see homicides.
I want to thank everybody for tuning in to Insights in Pediatric Neurosurgery, a podcast by the AANS and CNS Pediatrics section. Today, we're welcoming Dr. John Martin, who is professor and division chief at Connecticut Children's Hospital. And he has spent a lot of time studying and looking into firearms, as well as having experience in the military. He was enlisted as an infantryman in the Army, and then he went back and did his residency through the Army and was a major there and spent time in Iraq as well. And so we're very thankful to have his expertise today as we talk about firearms and firearms related injury in children.
Thanks, Dr. Spader. Happy to be here.
And we also have joining us Dr. Bolo from the University of Utah, who is the division chief for pediatric neurosurgery at the University of Utah, as well as Vijay Ravindra, who is a pediatric neurosurgeon currently serving in the U.S. Navy. Thank you guys very much for your time. So I want to start with a little bit of, John, your background and knowledge about firearms and kind of how you got into knowing about the content and exploring this area a little bit more.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I sort of started playing in this space in a pretty dark way. In 2012, I'm sitting here on call in December. And, you know, we see on CNN that there's a shooting in Newtown. It sounds messy. I've got friends who are first responders. They fill me in on what's going on. And we sat in the emergency room waiting for kids to come, and they didn't come. And I went home and talked to my daughters that night, who were in second and fifth grade, you know, just sort of to try to have some dialogue about this. And both of them were pretty upset and asked me what I was going to do about it. And that's ultimately the sort of genesis of you know, where I got engaged here. And, you know, my background, I've got a lot of background. When I was in high school, I was a biathlete. So that's skiing and shooting, if you're not familiar with it as a sport. So that was something that I was doing when I was very young. I enlisted in the Army and was in the infantry in late teens, early 20s. You know, I was a squad leader. I carried, you know, a squad automatic weapon for a period of time. So I mean, I'm familiar with firearms for sure. And then did my time on active duty in the Army as a physician to include a combat tour. So I've certainly seen, you know, what military grade weapons can do to human tissue. And then as a pediatric neurosurgeon, just like all of you, although not, I think, to the same volume as what you're seeing, Heather, you know, we've certainly all dealt with these kids. So, I mean, I'm pretty engaged and involved because I think, number one, it's personal to me. And number two, I feel like I can bring some level of understanding in the middle of the road, which really doesn't exist in politics and this topic right now. I think it's very polarized. And as someone told me, right, the only thing in the middle of the road on this thing is dead armadillos and yellow lions. And I think that's pretty close to true.
Yeah, I think your experience of, you know, people saying, what are you going to do? And parents, you know, what are you going to do? And when I was a resident, I saw two gunshot wounds in 7 years. And I was a resident in Rhode Island, and I think there were fewer guns and fewer gunshot wounds. Statistically, that is true compared to where I am in New Mexico now. And now we see them at least once a week. And it is, I mean, it's a huge change in my practice. And then I do want to talk a little bit about the article that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine in May of this year, because I think this is the point that kind of a lot of us saw this graphic. Firearms are the leading cause of death in children less than 19 years old. This is new from 2019 to 2020. There was a 13.5% increase in firearms deaths. And interestingly, most of that increase was homicides. So 33.4% of that was increase in homicides, and only 1.1% of that was suicides, which I thought was interesting because everybody says, oh, the pandemic, it was probably suicides, but that's not necessarily what we saw in those numbers. But I think the other sobering thing about this number is that the next largest cause of deaths are motor vehicle accidents, malignant neoplasms, and then drug overdoses and poisoning. So guns are more dangerous than getting in a car. And I think that that's why we wanted to do this episode, is just talk about what do we do. We can't just sit by and do nothing, but most of us have no idea what to do. So.
Yeah. VJ, Rob, any thoughts or perspectives? What are you seeing?
Yeah, I mean, we see a lot of firearm related trauma. So we see everything from, you know, the 2-year-old who picked up a loaded gun on the floor and shot themselves, to teenagers attempting suicide unsuccessfully, to homicide attempts. And it's chilling each and every time. So, I mean, Utah is a big gun state and we see a lot of trauma. It's part of the culture here because it's a geographically dispersed population. And hunting is certainly a part of what people do. It goes well beyond that. And I don't think we see a lot of, we see some hunting accidents, but I think that those are the small minority of firearms related neurotrauma that we see.
Yeah, I think in general, you know, the neurosurgical aspect of gunshot wound management is pretty, when we think about trauma, it's pretty rudimentary, right? You're gonna decompress and debride and try to achieve closure and minimize secondary injury. So it's just kind of neurosurgical trauma. But from a public health standpoint, it feels like there's a bigger statement that's going on here. It just seems so normal now that it's becoming so frightening. You know, I think that's the biggest issue that I have, is when I hear these things on the news and read them and then see the patients in the hospital, it really, it's becoming more commonplace. And I think for us, we need to move to a policy level, because the medicine side of it is what we do, right? We're trained to do this, but the policy side of it is, you know, everybody talks about staying in your lane. Well, this is our lane. We are directly in this lane and we're seeing some of the bad outcomes. And sure, some kids do well, but most don't, right? And so I think that's the biggest thing for me, is just, I hate how normal it's becoming.
Well, and I think for me, I've had kids who've attempted and succeeded in committing suicide, and can't tell you how many times the parents say, well, I knew there were guns in the house. No, they weren't secured properly. I just never thought my child would do something like this. And I think that in reading through the one of the resources I do want to cite for this is the American Academy of Pediatrics. On their website has significant amount of information and resources. And I think one of the things that I read that was stuck with me is, if you decide to commit suicide with a gun, you have a greater than 90% success rate. You know, if you decide to commit suicide through pills and other methods, you have a less than 5% success rate. But most people don't try to commit suicide twice. And so there's, you know, and they're basically less than 10% of suicides are a second attempt. But if you try to commit suicide with a gun, you're going to likely succeed. And I think that's the part we've all been in, that situation with that parent that knew perhaps their problems or not. 50% of the depressed kids that commit suicide, there wasn't a diagnosis of depression. And so again, the statistics that I cite are from the American Academy of Pediatrics website throughout this podcast. And I think it's interesting reading. But I also want to, for those people that actually don't know anything about guns, which I'm a little bit in that category, I'd like to just quickly have you guys explain, because I don't think everybody knows, and I don't think a lot of physicians know. I know what a handgun is, but I can't tell you quite what's a semi-automatic weapon, what's an automatic weapon, what's an assault weapon. And could you just give a brief primer on what those are? I mean, I had to learn, like, what's a full metal jacket, because some kid shot himself with something that didn't have a full metal jacket and I didn't know. And so John and BJ, could you give us a little more background?
I'm going to have to defer to my senior officer on this one.
Okay.
So, but I think, That was really that was a nice roundabout, and I will answer your question, Heather. But there are a couple of things that I'd point out from just listening to that conversation. The first is that physicians, by and large, a lot of physicians are poorly informed when it comes to firearms. They aren't familiar with the terminology of the language. They're uncomfortable counseling patients and families. And, you know, as a counterpart to that, families oftentimes don't want to take advice from their physicians because they think they're not knowledgeable. And a real key thing away from the firearms themselves is firearms are not like motor vehicles. Okay. Oftentimes I hear people, DJ, you raised the term public health, and this is a public health issue. It's right. There's an epidemic that's ongoing, but this is an endemic problem. This is not a new problem in the United States. And that's why, you know, again, Heather, your earlier point, I'm not at all shocked, when these shootings happen, because they will happen again. The mass shootings will continue to happen. And on a daily basis, depending on where you live, right? Depending on where you practice, you will see, you know, suicides. If you live in the inner city, you're going to see homicides, you know, small numbers. But, you know, if you take a look at young children, accidental deaths are going to happen too. And then, you know, sadly, mass shootings certainly are going to happen. When we look at how physicians oftentimes try to answer these questions, right, it's research. We want to focus on research. The thing that we really need to keep in mind is how that research is viewed by firearm owners, which is the ultimate goal of this research in their mind is you're trying to provide information that's going to justify confiscation and ban of firearms. That's how they look at it. That's how they view it. And in many ways, they're not wrong. I think oftentimes that is the goal of firearm researchers. And I think until we start engaging in honest dialogue and discussion, right, there are going to be some challenges with that. Vijay, you raised the famous tweet from 2018, right? The NRA saying, you know, that we should stay in our lane. And obviously that tweet, I mean, the tone deaf tweet and not well worded, but I do want to read the end of it. Right. Most upsetting, however, the medical community seems to have consulted no one but themselves. And I'll say they're right. When you take a look at a lot of the efforts that are being made, I think the fact that folks have not engaged firearm owners, you know, where they're from, with the exception of the American College of Surgeons, has been a real, it's been a failing point of a lot of the efforts that have gone on in terms of looking at how to solve the problem of firearm injuries and fatalities in the United States. The last thing I'm going to say before I shut up for a second, and we will get to the comment in terms of just some basics of firearms. But I think the American College of Surgeons, in particular, they surveyed their membership and they asked questions of surgeons that were firearm owners and surgeons that weren't, and they came up with this really interesting sort of narratives of firearm ownership, in which you had one group of surgeons that see firearms as generally harmful and unnecessary. They said, "Hey, this is decreasing my personal liberty, and it's emblematic of violence." And a group of firearm owners that are surgeons saying, you know what, they're generally beneficial, they're needed for personal protection, and they're emblematic of freedom. This is my right. And if you look at those two views, which of them is right? Well, of course, they're both right. But we can find common ground. And I think, again, looking at what the American College of Surgeons is really focused on, is we can start from a place where we say firearms are a liberty protected by the Constitution. And firearm violence is a major cause of preventable death and suffering. And both of those narratives can exist. And we can work this, provided we start bedrock with those two assumptions.
I still need you to explain to me the difference between the weapons. I'm sorry. I've been married to a man from South Dakota for 24 years, and I still don't know. So you will have to educate me on this.
So if we sit there and we take a look, the two largest categories of firearms in the United States of America, and, you know, if we're looking at how many firearms do we have in the United States right now, best guess is over 420 million firearms, selling at about 20 to 25 million firearms a year. So they're selling at a click. And, you know, the reality is this controversy has been very good for business. They've sold a lot of firearms as a result of fear that's been peddled in terms of people are going to take your guns away. All of the firearms that we're talking about tonight in terms of, you know, handguns or, you know, assault rifles, we'll you know, use those loose terms. Virtually all of these that you would see and probably encounter in your practice are going to be semi-automatic. And ultimately what that means is self-loading. Right. So if you look at what does a semi-automatic weapon do, it has, you know, some degree, most of these are magazine fed. Right. When you, and there's a couple of different actions, there's single action, double action. But in general, what ends up happening is when you discharge a round, either the force of the round being expelled pushes the bolt back, or in some of them, there's a gas operator to do this, but it cycles, loads another round. And a semi-automatic action means you need to pull the trigger every single time, right, to dispense a round. But if you take a look at how quickly you can do that very, very quickly with either a semi-automatic pistol or rifle.
So when there was an assault weapons ban, mm-hmm. what was included in those weapons? Do you know?
So it gets interesting, right? So if you take a look at how an assault weapon was defined by Congress, and I'm just got a note up here because it does get a bit right. You've got legislators trying to write policy and or law that defines what an assault weapon is, and you know it's slippery business. So if you take a look, they included a folding telescope, a scoping stock, a threaded barrel, a flash suppressor, bayonet mount, shroud allowing the shooter to hold gun with both hands, and a pistol grip. And the reality is I live in a state that has an assault weapon ban. And yet you can certainly purchase a rifle that has every quality that you would associate with an assault weapon simply by being knowledgeable about firearms. So if you play around with the length of the barrel, if you play around with, you know, other features like a vertical mounted foregrip, if you take the stock away and you have, you know, an alternative device back there, you can buy a weapon that in every way that you would look at it would resemble an AR-15 right now in the state of Connecticut for anywhere from $700 to $1,500.
And I think that's an interesting point, because for people that are not familiar with guns, I think it's generally sold as and I think there are, again, Australia did a gun buyback program. It worked well. You know, the assault rifle ban, there's a question, did it decrease the number of weapons? But what you're saying, and I have heard this over and over again, is it probably that is not going to make a significant difference. And then the other thing, which is also the flashpoint that everybody talks about, are mass shootings, which of course is the thing that grabs all of our attention, but really are less than 1% of the deaths. And I think when we talked about doing this podcast, we thought, okay, we're not actually going to talk about the mass shootings, because as horrible and horrific and as much press as they get, that's probably not where we can make the biggest difference. Would you say that that's probably true, that as physicians, that's not where that our biggest yield?
Well, I think they're a trap. You know, if you take a look, right, you know, highly publicized mass shootings have always driven Americans to act. I mean, if you take a look, go back and take a look at sort of when Congress has acted, going all the way back to 1934, right? The Valentine's Day massacre is what ended up, you know, sort of bringing the National Firearms Act into being. And you can bring that right up through Uvalde in terms of, you know, causing Congress to act just last year, right? So mass shootings have always been motivators to make legislators move. They have always done that. But as physicians who are saying that they want to take action based on public health, I do think that assault weapons and high capacity magazines end up being a trap for the reasons that you say. They're less than 1% of the firearm fatalities that we confront. So yes, I agree.
Yeah, Dr. Martin, you bring up a really interesting point, because, you know, you talk about how that statement, that tweet from, you know, whenever it was very much that they, you know, the physicians consulted their own spectrum to make that statement. And so how do we get out of that? You know, I mean, that's my thing. It's like, you know, yeah, this is going to be a great conversation, but I mean, what am I supposed to do moving forward? Am I supposed to go to my congressman or my senator? Or, I mean, I just don't know really how to proceed.
Yeah. What I will say is that is exactly what this lobby is counting on. They're counting on the fact that firearm injuries in the United States, right? They're different depending on if you're urban or rural. They're different if you are an adult or a pediatric provider. They are different depending on what state you live in. And so, you know, again, you know, speaking purely as John Martin and not as, you know, any sort of mouthpiece for any organization. What I would tell you is I think that there are opportunities for us to act locally. And I think that's what I would encourage people to do. I think that, you know, the reality is if you are practicing in an urban setting, there are certainly opportunities to engage with hospital-based violence intervention programs. If you are practicing in a rural community, educating yourself in terms of how to counsel, and again, you're not a primary care provider, but most neurosurgeons are involved in their local trauma programs. Get involved with your trauma program in terms of educating folks within your community, their primary care, in terms of how to intelligently talk to people about lethal mean restriction in household at risk. I mean, Heather, you raised an excellent point. You know, the reality is if you take a look at, you know, the children that we take care of, you know, there certainly are, you know, depending on a very specific group, transgender kids, 6 times the suicide rate of children who don't. Those are definitely households where you hope that parents are aware of those statistics and hope that they think about the safety of their child relative to firearms. But, you know, and again, not to, you know, talk in circles here, but also understand that you need to meet firearm owners where they are. And so if you tell people the safest household is, you know, a firearm that is, you know, separate from ammunition, it's locked and it's unloaded, the parent who thinks that they own a firearm to protect their family is going to tell you that that's insane. And so I think, you know, a lot of this, there's some really good educational resources out there. And I apologize, they may not all be with the AAP in terms of how to talk to firearm owners about these issues. Because again, I think there's a reason why physicians are oftentimes not viewed as people who are arbiters of good advice, because they just don't have the knowledge. But those are the sort of, if you say, what can we do about this? I don't know that the answer is necessarily national. Certainly, well, the country's not ready for any more national action right now, in my opinion. But I think that every single one of us, you know, I'm looking at the three other people on this podcast, you are all leaders within your community. And our group of pediatric neurosurgeons, they are all leaders within their trauma community. And I think that there are some fantastic resources that can be tapped into locally that can be helpful.
So as I was reading for this, you know, the statistic that in the 1990s, most of the primary reason for firearm ownership was hunting. And that has shifted. So as of 2019, 66% of U.S. firearm owners report they own firearms for protection. Mm-hmm. However, firearms are used for self-defense in less than 1% of crimes. And so trying to like deal with that gulf between gun owners and non-gun owners. You know, a lot of times or physicians would counsel actually that gun is not going to provide you self-defense because statistically the statistics don't play out on that. But what you're saying is no one really wants to hear that argument. And so
that's actually not what I'm saying is we don't know that argument. So another great resource, right? If you take a look at you brought up legislation earlier on, and that gets messy too, because, you know, a lot of the legislation that's been passed from state to state, it's not uniform. And so the law that's, you know, a child access protection law that's passed in the state of Connecticut is not going to be the same that's passed in the state of New York. And so differences between those make it very difficult to figure out what's working and what isn't. And nobody or almost nobody is tracking things that you're talking about, which is defensive gun use. And they're really two there are a couple of papers, from the 90s, I believe. I apologize, I didn't do any prep relative to this, but there isn't a lot of data out there that looks at defensive gun use, which is, the ultimate metric that you're interested in when you talk about the firearm being used for protection.
So you're basically saying that statistic is perhaps dubious.
I'm saying that nobody knows the answer, right? Because again, the research that's being done, I think number one, there was very limited funding for firearm research for a long time. Number two, the people that were involved in doing a lot of that research really fell into, two very disparate groups, people who, clearly had an axe to grind in terms of firearms are beneficial and vice versa. I think it's, when partisanship is present in the research as well, nobody is well served. Another thing, you sit there and you talk about what can we lobby for that actually would make sense. I think it's Rebecca. I'll get that. I apologize to her if I get it wrong, but Rebecca Cunningham has done a lot of the papers that you're citing here relative to, an increase in firearm violence in kids. She also did a great paper back in 2019 that was looking at how underserved or under-resourced research into firearm injuries in children is. So if you sit there and take a look, right, based on the burden of disease, we should be funding $44 million a year of pediatric firearm injury research. And the reality is, we were back when that paper was published, somewhere in the $1 million a year range. So, that's an area where, getting out and talking to legislators, it could potentially do some good at a federal level.
It's interesting because, the conversation could be very different, right? Should we be talking about, we're not going to talk about constitutional rights here, and I don't think we should, but should it be just about gun safety and home management? Should you, what do you focus your efforts on? And I think for me, that's the most interesting thing that you said. We're not going to change gun owners' opinions, right? I lived with a guy in college who had an NRA credit card. I mean, you're not going to change that, right? But you are going to impact people if you talk about safety and management and good conduct and things like that. And I think that for me is a conversation that I've never kind of focused toward. It's like, well, why are we having so many shootings? Why are there so many guns out there? And that's not the issue. It's more, they're out there, like you said, with the millions and millions of firearms that are available. But how do we teach people to behave properly and act safely,
Right. So Veej, just to, clarify your point, or the majority of deaths, 85% from firearms in younger children. So that's from 0 to 12 years old, occur in the home. Mm-hmm. And older children are as likely to be killed at home, 39%, or the street or sidewalk, 38%. But when I read that number, it did say, okay, wait a second. So all these kids under 12, most of these are happening at home. And I don't know a single parent that wants their child to be killed with a gun, right? I mean, that doesn't exist. Yeah. And so there is a real opportunity there because there's a gap in knowledge of how this happens. And then I guess I think what I'm searching for is, how do I convince that parent that yes, your child really will get the gun, or yes, your child really might try to commit suicide? And even if you don't think your child is depressed, it's still something that could really happen in 50% of the kids that are committing suicide. And as a pediatric neurosurgeon, I don't necessarily interact with the parents as much as a pediatrician, but we do. I mean, we know our families well, we see them, some of them we see as much as a pediatrician because we see them annually. Mm-hmm. And so, my plea and my the thing I want to say is I don't want you to come to me after a child's shot themselves. I can't do anything. I can't fix it. I cannot put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Right. But how do I convince them that the guns really come from households that care about their kids? But bad things happen.
Well, and like anything, you know, and big data has highlighted this over and over again, is the socioeconomic impact, right? We know that that's a huge factor that plays into gun violence and gun deaths and gun injuries. And so it's, we've identified it, and now we need to figure out a way to level the playing field. And I think that's the biggest mountain to climb on. And Dr. Martin, I don't know if you feel the same way, but to me, I read that, I was like, well, great. We just have to fix disparity. Awesome. You know, like.
Well, and it's been, I mean, I think the reality is that if you look at an organization like the American College of Surgeons, and the American Academy of Family Physicians has been active in this. The American College of Physicians has been active in this. You know, ultimately, there are a lot of organizations that recognize the contributions disparities in socioeconomic status lend to this problem. And I think that's been a huge area of focus of these organizations towards, you know, how do we solve this? Where do we work? And there's, again, hospital-based violence intervention programs. There's a collective called the HAVI, H-A-V-I, if you want to do some reading on that, where there's some fantastic work that's being done out there around the country. And as sort of a staggering comment that was made by the director of the HAVI at a recent firearm summit in Chicago was, if you take a look at the number of homicides that are committed in children nationally every year, they're really aggregated into a finite number of urban centers, right? I mean, it's not so much a national problem as there are these, you know, hotbeds. And if you just targeted those areas, you could make a huge difference in terms of bringing down those numbers. And again, that's, if you take a look within children, right, it's different on the adult side. Children, it's close to 2/3 of the injuries and, you know, folks who are 24 and under are going to be, or deaths are homicide, and about 1/3 suicide. And on the adult side, it's flipped. You know, see about 1/3 are homicide and almost 2/3 are suicide. So it's looking at something that's a very heterogeneous problem. There are ways to chip away at it, but there's not a golden ticket here. There's not one big solution to be arrived at. And I think that's what we all want. It's what we all hope for. It's just not reality.
If you were a policymaker and you had your one thing that you could do in these areas that are most afflicted, what would be the one thing that you would do?
Yeah. Right. I mean, I think there are certain third rails, right? I think if you sit there and you take a look, registration of firearms is a third rail, right? This is, if you sit there and say, we are going to do universal background checks with a goal of getting to, you know, a national registry, that is a non-starter. And in fact, I will tell you that the opposition that is, they've been working this problem for decades. They're well-funded. They have a base that are one-issue voters, right? There are people, this is what they vote on. So these people take a look at, you know, your idea. And if anything that you're looking at sniffs of registration or confiscation, you're done. So I really think you have to be very careful about that. As we stated earlier, I think assault weapon bans are a trap for physicians. And I personally, it's not that I don't care. It's maybe I'm a hypocrite. That's why I get dragged into this to begin with, in terms of just imagining my own kid laying on a floor of a school in Newtown.
But what about if your gun was like your iPhone and you had to have like the face ID or the thumbprint ID?
So what are you going to do about the 420 million units that are already out there?
Right.
And, you know, the other thing, you know, when we sit here and we talk about why firearms are different, right? I mean, you know, the reality is when you look at consumer safety, right, they're the one domestically produced product that was exempt when that organization was established in the 1970s, right? So you can't, it's very difficult to mandate any of these things.
Well, and that is an interesting point. Firearms are the only consumer product in the U.S. that are not regulated for safety, which I think is astonishing. I did not know that until I was doing the research for this.
Why are you astonished by that?
Well, I mean, it just seems like not the worst idea in the world.
Yeah, but the thing is, I agree. It's not the worst thing in the world, but these are dedicated. These are people, the people who are, you know, who it's the same thing in terms of Second Amendment constitutional law. If you think that 2008, 2012 and 2022, really the three only Supreme Court decisions that, you know, have transformed the landscape relative to this, if you think those were accidental, I mean, they've been working. This was a 50-year effort on the part of a very powerful lobby and a very committed group of Americans. And again, you can agree or disagree with them, right? That is your right and their right. But they've just played this game a whole lot better.
Well, and I think, you know, a lot of us have not been playing any game, right? Like, there's no strategy. There's no...
You know, you were playing a game.
Right. Well, so the other thing, when you look at that New England Journal article, is that when you look at motor vehicle deaths, they have come down. And so I think one of the other things is, how did it come down? Well, there was a very focused strategy on harm prevention, but like, no one's saying don't get in a car. And no one's actually... The driving age wasn't... I mean, some places the driving age was increased, but I mean, in general, the strategy for motor vehicle accidents and reducing motor vehicle harm has worked, but we also are able to regulate cars a little bit more.
Heather, what we said that's so important is that we all use cars, right? I mean, there's probably some people in urban areas, but the vast majority of us see the need for a car, understand that it's dangerous, put our families in it every day. And so there isn't this dichotomy of people who have like polar opposite views, like Jonathan was talking about with the ACS survey of even two groups of surgeons among us. And I was just really moved by the idea of acting locally. You know, I think I was thinking a lot about like motor vehicle collisions and all the things that we've done to make motor vehicles safer. But you can look at things like, you know, Mothers Against Drunk Driving or other things that are sort of people who have an interest in decreasing, you know, unnecessary deaths associated with motor vehicles without telling you you shouldn't drive a car. Or, you know, car seats are another thing. Obviously, they're regulated, but, you know, I mean, I think there are very few families that wouldn't put their kid in a car seat. We see it sometimes, but it's, you know... I think that there's examples where we could act locally. We could cite some of these statistics. We could work through our trauma organizations and our hospitals to at least make an impact locally on the deaths of children. I think that as a physician and not a politician is a very
important. You would do a lot more than that by doing exactly what you say. I went with a group of surgeons here in Hartford. We went to some gun clubs and gun ranges to have conversations with firearm owners about suicide, right? There's some really wonderful instructional slide decks that have been produced talking about this, this particular topic, and going in and just, you know, having a conversation with them about the numbers, because we have numbers on that, right? There's data looking at this, and telling them that you know, that there are people who care, and there are mechanisms. You can talk to a friend and, you know, they can take your firearm away for a period of time. Right? I mean, this and it doesn't have to be a cop, right? There are different ways to approach this problem. So I walked into, imagine a physician walking into a gun club to have this conversation. And, you know, and we did. And after, you know, after sort of went through the slide deck, a guy stood up and he said, you know, my best friend owned this firing, this gun store up in Enfield. And he put a you know, a pistol in his mouth and he blew his head off last week. This is important. You know, to your point, Heather, the reality is nobody wants to see their kid die at home or die going to school. And I think that when you have conversations with people one-on-one, what you do is you build credibility. As long as you're willing to talk and you're willing to listen. And I think if we could do that, right, locally and regionally, and build some trust back, listen to one another, I think there might be space for us to have other discussions down the road. But I'll be honest, I don't mean to be a nihilist, but I don't think that time and place is now, not with the lack of trust that's there. I think that we are tragically, you know, potentially, you know, years or even decades away from that. And it's sad. But I think you can either throw up your hands and say that nothing can be done, or you can make a difference in your own community. And the reality is, I think, isn't that what citizenship is, right? Isn't that what, you know, being, you know, accountable to, right, our department, our hospital, and our community is all about? I think there we can make a difference.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, I think, Rob, you mentioned this. It's such a partisan issue, right, that it becomes enveloped in this whole other argument that people love to get into, but we never really seem to reach a consensus, right? So I think it's not, you know, it's easy to throw your hands up because it is difficult. But at the same time, I think what you said, acting locally may be the best thing that we can do to kind of head this off. So yeah, it's an interesting question.
I mean, if you ask me, Heather, you know, John, what are you doing, you know, about this? You know, are there bigger stages? And the answer is, I think there are, but I think you, in terms of a lot of the national efforts that are going on right now, I honestly think in ways they're not well conceived. And I think they're missing the message that, you know, the NRA was trying to, sort of convey in that message, that physicians are, or they're only, you know, taking their own advice on this. They're only listening to themselves. And I think there are a group of physician firearm owners that are trying, you know, to, you know, find space and create trust with some organizations, but I don't know. I think it's a huge challenge, one that I'm trying to find a way down that road, but there's not a clear way forward to do that nationally right now. We're trying.
And listening to this discussion, it sounds like, I mean, we are discussing firearms, but the greater issue really is a one of how do we engage with people for whom we have different views? And it's not just firearms. It is not being in our silos and having to engage people of different backgrounds and different hobbies and different interests. You know, my husband always says, he's like, do you want to be right or do you want to be effective? And I think, you know, I can tell people statistics like, well, that gun's not going to protect you. I mean, statistically, it's probably not going to protect you. And that it's probably not going to help do anything. But, you know, you sit down, you have a meal with a gun owner and really talk to them about what we see in the ER and what really bothers us. You know, it's the suicides, it's the accidents. I think if they, I don't know. I feel like if people could see what we see, you know, and if we could convey it in a less tone deaf manner, we could be more effective.
Well, it's hard, right? Because we're all reactionary, right? We never deal with preventative health. You know, we don't treat hypertension. We treat the aneurysm, you know what right. I'm saying? And so it's a little bit, this is kind of different for us. It's a little bit of a different way to think. And I think it is necessary because we can make a difference, but your point is totally well taken.
Well, and I think you're absolutely on point, Heather. I mean, the earlier comment that I made about what has brought legislators to the table, and the reality is it's dead kits, right? Right. That is what brings people to the table. And it's sad, right? But that is it. And if you sit there and you take a look at, right, what are the most lethal injuries that are inflicted on the human body? Well, right. I mean, take a swing at somebody's head, it tends to work pretty well. Firearm injuries to the head, you know, have very high lethality, and they tend to be very dramatic stories. And we don't have to look any further than, you know, Jay Wellens, our colleague, you know, who just published, you know, his narrative in terms of stories within pediatric neurosurgery. In addition to having a lot of power locally in your trauma and healthcare system, everyone that is in the group that's here today, and you know, hopefully in the group of pediatric neurosurgeons that will listen to this, we are all good storytellers too, right? We have to tell stories in order to get families to come to the table to accept the treatments that we recommend. I think that, you know, many of you have amused me with stories at national meetings, either, you know, sort of in or out of the meeting room, right? I think the ability to tell stories about the patients and how they've touched you and how their families have been affected can be another way that you can potentially move the needle, if not only locally, maybe even nationally, you never know. But I think that's an excellent point. We have compelling stories to tell and we should tell them.
One last statistics I want to leave you with is that $597 was spent on research per pediatric firearm death, 26,000 for each motor vehicle related death, and 195,000 for each pediatric cancer death. So we have a lot of work to do in this area.
Yeah.
Does anybody have any other parting thoughts that before we finish up today?
Well, I think the advice about working locally is something I'm personally going to take to heart. And I think hopefully our listeners will too, because it's not something I've thought of doing before, you know, but I think we have to be part of the problem. Part of the solution, not part of the problem. So,
yeah, I will tell you one of the things that I've been considering, and we're still waiting for this paper from the American College of Surgeons to come out of quarantine relative to the recent firearm summit. But I do think putting together, you know, sort of a clearinghouse of resources, you know, for our group, both the ASPN and the pediatric section, in terms of where to go to get this advice. Potentially, you know, there are some educational deficits, Heather, as you point out, in terms of maybe a primer on, you know, firearms. I'm sure they are out there. But if I can't find something to link to a website on this, it's certainly something we could easily compile. But I think there probably is a real need for us to have something like that available to our membership. And I'll commit to working to accomplish that.